Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok says the political deal he has signed with the military grants him complete freedom in forming a government of technocrats. Many people are injured as a car plows through a holiday parade in the U.S. state of Wisconsin. Also in the headlines, public anger continues to simmer in the U.S. over the acquittal of a militia member who fatally shot two anti-racism protesters in August 2020. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, things seem to be settling down in Sudan. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who's reinstated by the military after last month's coup, says he has been granted complete freedom to form a government of technocrats. Hamdok reportedly made the remark hours after inking a political deal with the military. Reports say the two sides also agreed to hold elections by July 2023. Earlier on Sunday, the country's military reinstated Hamdok and promised to release all political prisoners. The premier said he had agreed to the deal to stop the bloodshed, but the opposition and trade unions have voiced their opposition to the agreement. They are demanding a full civilian rule in Sudan. The development comes after weeks of deadly unrest triggered by the October 25 coup. More than 40 protesters have been killed in the military crackdown since then. Political commentator Jonathan Ofe-Ansah says it is unlikely the military will completely disengage itself from Sudan's politics.
I am not very sure. Though on paper he's going to be given a free hand, in reality, I doubt if the military is going to give me a free hand. Because most the demand of the civilian protesters has been, you know, for the military to totally disengage from the country's political terrain, and this they haven't done. They are still part of the transitional government, so I'm not sure that Abdullah Hamdok is going to have 100% control. I do admire, you know, the resolve of the Sudanese people. We mustn't forget that it was largely through their persistent protest that, you know, led to the overthrow of the former president al-Bashir 2 years ago. And they are determined. I think the people of Sudan must have taken their cue from the Arab Spring, which was largely successful. And I believe they are not going to give in until, you know, they see their demands met fully.
A vehicle has driven through a holiday parade in the U.S. state of Wisconsin, leaving more than 20 people injured. At least one suspect is in custody in connection with the incident, which happened in the city of Waukesha. A video posted on social media showed a red SUV speeding toward marchers from behind. In another video, police appeared to open fire on the same vehicle as it crashed through street barriers. The SUV barreled down the street into people marching in the city's Christmas parade. As seen in the footage, the driver of the vehicle kept going and did not stop as it rammed into the crowd. Public anger continues to simmer in the United States over the acquittal of a militia member who fatally shot two anti-racism protesters in August 2020. Protesters marched in different cities across the country, condemning the court's verdict that the shootings by Kyle Rittenhouse were in self-defense. In the city of Kenosha, Wisconsin, people gathered for a rally organized by faith leaders and activists to protest the acquittal of Rittenhouse. In Chicago, demonstrators hit the streets chanting Black Lives Matter. They also carried signs reading White Supremacy Equals Terrorism. Protests also erupted in Tampa, Florida, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Rittenhouse verdict has sparked fierce criticism of the country's justice system and its preferential treatment of white supremacists. In other news, polling stations have closed and counting has begun in Chile's general elections, with over 70% of the ballots counted. Far-right presidential candidate José Antonio Kast is leading with over 28% of the vote. Gabriel Boric, who represents the left-wing coalition, is second with over 23%. A runoff will be held on December 9 if none of the candidates in the fray obtains an outright majority. Under the next president, Chile will draft a new constitution. People already selected members of the body in charge of drafting the new text. A new constitution was the main demand of protesters who took to the streets in 2019. On Sunday, voters also cast their ballots to choose members of the 155-seat Chamber of Deputies and almost two-thirds of senators. His correspondent in the Chilean capital, Alejandro Kirk, joined us earlier with the latest on the country's general election.
So the estimate is that in some stations, something like 70% of voters have turned out, which is not normal here. About who is going to win, still early to say. The final count is scheduled for around from about 2 hours from now, but that's not going to happen most likely because of what I just said. You can see that many people are here are still voting, and the vote count will be delayed maybe for an hour or two. Anyway, this large turnout means that this election is important, that it is polarized between the field of people who protested and want change and those who want to stop that change, the process of the constitutional process, and go back to what it was like before the uprising of 2019.
Elections have also been held in Venezuela. People there have cast their ballots in regional and municipal elections. The votes will choose more than 3,000 governors, mayors, and city council members across Venezuela. Over 21 million people are eligible to cast the ballots. The opposition is also participating in the elections, breaking years of electoral boycott. President Nicolas Maduro and U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido have urged their supporters to vote. The elections are being observed by more than 130 international monitors, mostly from the European Union. That's the first such European mission in Venezuela since 2006. Camila Escalante joined us earlier with more details about the elections in Venezuela.
I don't think there was ever really popularity for Juan Guaido, the figure or politician, to begin with, except in his own constituency when he won his seat to the National Assembly for 2015 for that period. I believe that there was support for a coup and support for an opposition generally, but there were many other opposition leaders at the time that were far more popular. But the United States didn't want to take a chance with people with the kind of background that they had supporting the Guarimba violent terrorist protests here, and they wanted to find someone clean and new. This is why they pulled a complete nobody. But going back to the elections today, everyone has remarked on the normality and the way in which everything has been carried out so calmly and in such an organized manner. Both the electoral observers, foreign electoral observers who've been here many times before and kind of know the process, and those who've been here for the first time. So far we haven't heard anything in the way of claims of fraud or any irregularities. So we're waiting to see some of the first statements officially given by the National Electoral Council this evening.
Elsewhere, Belgian police clash with protesters rallying against new COVID-19 restrictions in the capital, Brussels. The police have used tear gas and water cannons to disperse angry demonstrators. Some 35,000 people are estimated to have participated in the rally. Belgium announced tougher restrictions last week in response to a rapid rise in its coronavirus caseload. The measures include a mask mandate for anyone over 10 years of age for indoor and some outdoor activities. The new restrictions also require employees to work 4 days a week from home. Europe is once again turning into a hotbed for the pandemic. Several European governments have announced the new restrictions, which were also met with widespread anger.
Coronavirus restrictions are returning to Europe as the governments struggle to tackle the resurgence of the pandemic. The measures have sparked protests in several European countries. Cities across the Netherlands saw fiery riots erupt for a second night, with angry mobs running amok in The Hague. Hooded protesters torched bicycles on Saturday night and threw stones and fireworks at police. Officers, some on horseback, responded by charging on the crowd and making arrests. But the rally in the capital Amsterdam remained largely peaceful amid a heavy police presence. During the first night of the unrest in the port city of Rotterdam, police opened fire on protesters, injuring a few and rounded up dozens. The Netherlands has imposed a 3-week partial lockdown after registering a record spike in COVID cases. The government is also planning to ban unvaccinated people from entering public places, but the opponents argue that such restrictions are not the answer.
I expect from our leaders to have a long-term vision. We don't see a long-term vision. We just see repeating the same measures over and over again and not working.
Also in Austria, a 20-day nationwide lockdown and a plan to make jabs mandatory have brought tens of thousands to the streets of Vienna. Austria is the first European country to make vaccination a legal requirement. But the protesters believe the government is only restricting their freedom. Croatians, frustrated by COVID measures, marched through the capital Zagreb in their thousands to tell the government enough is enough. Refusing to wear protective masks, the protesters called for the government to scrap compulsory vaccinations for public sector workers.
I came to support all the people who oppose COVID passports because it's actually a measure that divides us into citizens and non-citizens, and it leads to great discrimination even towards totalitarianism.
I think that our government is doing the same thing countries that collaborated with Nazi Germany did in the 1940s.
The COVID pass for civil servants also enraged thousands of Danes who came out in Copenhagen to call on the government to cancel the measure. The World Health Organization is warning that Europe is the only region in the world with surging deaths and that the virus could kill 500,000 more people by February. 70 million infections, 1.6 million deaths, and still counting. For now, it seems that governments across Europe are facing the double dilemma of keeping the protests in check and bringing the fresh wave of infections under control.
Elsewhere, 4 years ago today, Iranian top military commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in a letter to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, confirmed that the Daesh terror group had been fully eliminated. That after years of barbaric brutality and bloodshed committed by the group against the armies and the civilian population of Iraq and Syria.
The Daesh terror group, known mainly as the ISIS or ISIL in the Western world, was founded by Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi and became known internationally in 2014 after driving Iraqi security forces out of key cities in lightning attacks followed by its capture of the strategic city of Mosul. For several years, the group carried out the most brutal attacks against civilians and government forces in both Iraq and Syria. Just to name a few, the Sinjar massacre, during which thousands of Yazidis were butchered, and the killing of more than 2,000 cadets and personnel at a military academy in Iraq's Tikrit. They also inflicted irreparable damage on Iraq's vital infrastructure. The savagery against the civilian populations was beginning to raise concerns in the international community about the situation in the two Arab countries. Several regional nations, including Iran, were already viewing Daesh as a national security threat. That prompted Iranian authorities to move to assign top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, to take on a military advisory role to help those countries eradicate the terror group. With the liberation of Abu Kamal, a Syrian city close to the border with Iraq that was the last stronghold held by Daesh terrorists, and the bringing down of the flag of the terrorist group and the raising of the flag of Syria, General Soleimani announced the termination of the rule of Daesh. In a letter sent to Iran's leader in November 2017, the commander outlined who had been behind the creation of the terror group.
All these crimes have been designed and implemented by U.S. leaders and organizations according to the acknowledgement of the highest-ranking U.S. official who is currently president of the United States. Moreover, these schemes are still being modified and implemented by current American leaders.
The Iranian commander also hailed Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani for mobilizing all facilities to fight the scourge and praised resistance forces in Iraq and Syria for their role in defeating the terrorist group.
Certainly, the resistance of the Iraqi and Syrian governments and the perseverance of the armies and youth of these two countries, especially the highly popular mobilization forces and other Muslim youths from other countries with the prominent presence of Hezbollah led by its great leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, played an important role in overturning this dangerous event.
General Soleimani also acknowledged Iran's role in bringing the life of Daesh to an end.
Definitely the valuable role of the nation and the governments of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the respected president in particular, the parliament, the defense ministry, as well as police, military and security organizations of our country in supporting the above-mentioned states and nations is admirable.
General Soleimani, along with commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, in January 2020 as part of a plot to remove a force against a group created by the U.S. and its allies to pursue their political goals in West Asia.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the years after the U.S. pledged to invest in human rights and rule of law, the Pentagon spent millions training elite Mexican units how to fight, says Ryan Devois Ryder in an article published under the heading, U.S. Military Training in Mexico Increased as Human Rights Waned, new database reveals. Stay tuned for more. Families in the Mexican state of Tamaulipas were left reeling last week after a federal judge released from custody 12 members of an elite U.S.-trained special operations unit accused of kidnapping their loved ones. According to the families, the Mexican Marines orchestrated a wave of terror during their six-month deployment in the city of Nuevo Laredo, just across the border from Laredo, Texas, that resulted in at least 47 abductions in 2018. The bodies of 19 victims were later recovered, some bearing signs of torture. 25 people remain missing, including a teenage U.S. citizen. The youngest of the victims was a 14-year-old boy. Drawing international condemnation, the disappearances in Tamaulipas are significant, not only for the acts of Mexican Marines are accused of perpetrating, but also because the Marines, as an institution, have been the U.S. government's most trusted drug war ally in Mexico for more than a decade, receiving extensive training, operational support, and praise from the U.S. military and law enforcement agencies. A new database released this week provides the most detailed picture to date of what the U.S. government's relationship to the Mexican Marines has looked like on the ground, revealing the extensive tactical training that the Pentagon has provided to the Marines elite units and other elements of the Mexican military. Launched by the Mexico Violence Resource Project at the University of California, San Diego, the database allows the users to search through more than 6,000 instances of U.S. military training for Mexican security forces spanning nearly two decades and totaling nearly $144 million in U.S. taxpayer funding. According to Michael Lettiori, a managing editor of the Mexico Violence Resource Project and lead analyst and designer of the project, the data drawn from annual Pentagon and State Department reports to Congress reveals that tactical and lethal training for Mexican military units, especially the Mexican Marines, by the U.S. military has increased substantially over the past decade, while human rights instruction has sharply decreased. One hand is saying we are building up the justice system and the civilian police, and on the other hand is saying we are making your military really good at killing people. Lettiori told Intercept, adding, I don't know that it's an incoherent foreign policy, but it's certainly a slightly deceptive one. Last month, top officials from the U.S. and Mexico met to discuss replacing the Merida Initiative, a $3.5 billion aid package that has been the public face of U.S.-Mexico security cooperation since 2007, with a new bilateral security framework. More than 300,000 people have been killed in Mexico since former President Felipe Calderón deployed the military in a stated war on drug trafficking in 2006. More than 100,000 others have disappeared. Security forces at all levels have a well-documented history of systematic human rights abuses. In 2011, the U.S. and Mexico agreed to a reorganization of Merida that would strengthen law enforcement institutions, enhance criminal prosecutions and the rule of law, build public confidence in the justice sector, improve border security, promote greater respect for human rights, and prevent crime and violence. The shift was seen among some close trackers of the U.S.-Mexico security relationship as a potential move away from the militarized drug war model that has fueled unprecedented levels of violence and instability in the country. And the database complicates that picture. Significant chunks of Merida spending have indeed gone to civil society programs in Mexico in the past decade, largely through the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department. However, the government's own records show that the Pentagon has taken the opposite track since 2011, doubling down on tactical training while moving away from human rights instruction. While the database captures the language proficiency and technical training courses one might expect to find in a binational security partnership, it also features extensive records of recent and larger scale training operations involving U.S. personnel in Mexico, including dozens of unit-level pre-deployment training missions involving upward of 140 Marines at a time, combat shooting courses, martial arts courses, airborne parachute courses, tactical driving courses, asset interdiction courses, aerial warfare courses, and more. The top line story that everybody is giving, all the Merida spending is going to justice reform, and it's not just about shooting the baddies anymore, Littori said, adding, I would say what the Pentagon is doing is hear how you shoot the baddies. Information in the database first organized by Security Force Monitor, a Columbia Law School project, shows that from 2007 to 2012, the U.S. provided tactical training to an average of 261 members of Mexican security forces annually. After 2012, that number jumped to 1,454. The Mexican Marines were the primary beneficiary of the explosion in training, representing nearly 60% of the Pentagon's students and receiving nearly half. That is $46.3 million of the $101.2 million spent post-2011. From 2013 to 2019, while tactical training was surging, the Pentagon provided human rights training to just 27 students, only 12 of whom came from the Mexican military. Combined Pentagon and State Department funding on human rights training post-2012 came out to a mere $212,000. Lettieri went into the project neither searching for nor expecting to find the post-2011 increase in tactical training. But as he continued to work with the data, the shift became clear. When you look at it over time, it just jumps off the page that it's tactical, he said. It wasn't just the Marines, known in Mexico as a smear, receiving tactical training. He discovered the army known as Sedena also received extensive Pentagon support at a tactical level. The finding was significant because Washington has couched its embrace of the Marines as allies in the drug war in Mexico in the perceived unreliability of the army as a trustworthy partner in matters of operational security and human rights. Sedena has long been one of Mexico's most powerful institutions. It has also been tied to many of the country's worst state crimes, including the 2014 disappearance of 43 college students in the state of Guerrero. The database provides just one glimpse into a much wider world of security exchanges between the U.S. and Mexico, Lettieri said, most of which is inaccessible to the public. It does not include, for example, information on the enormous array of arms Mexico purchases from the U.S. or where those arms ultimately end up, nor does it reveal anything about the extensive training and cooperation that occurs between state and local law enforcement agencies on the two sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. Thanks to the joint State Department and Pentagon report on foreign military training that's delivered to Congress each year, we have some ability to understand this section of U.S. interaction with Mexico, Lettieri said. Still, he added, there is a whole bunch of stuff we don't know very much about. That's the key takeaway here. There is a whole bunch of money being spent, but we don't have even this minimal kind of accountability.
Thank you. WRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. WRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint on WRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and my dear guest in the studio, sitting with me here in the studio, Brother Habib and Brother Mahdi. Assalamu alaikum to both of you. First, let me start with you.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much, Brother Habib, at your service. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you guys.
Thank you very much. And Brother Mahdi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Mahdi, and I'm really glad to be here with you guys, inshallah.
My pleasure.
Enjoy well, this night.
Thank you very much. In these series of programs, we are in fact delving into some issues, and we hope and expect you in fact to contribute as much as you can to the topics that are raised usually. And one of those interesting and controversial topics that may have in fact pros and cons very much everywhere in every media you can name it is social media. Well, there are lots of people who are against it. Lots of other people who are like totally love it, you know, and sometimes they're addicted to that extent. All right, Brother Habib, what are you? I mean, like, which one of you do you support? Would you like social media? Do you think social media would be a huge benefit, in fact, to the human race whatsoever?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. I think that it is good to a point where it is controllable. If it's left unleashed, I think it will be very hectic, chaotic, and it will have a lot of bad influences on the society altogether and individuals precisely. I think that the one of the main things that we forget is that social media is now, it's your life. It's social, it's community, mm-hmm. but what is it now? It's between your hands, it's on electricity, mm-hmm. it needs internet. Mm-hmm. Your life now is all into this all on these devices and whatnot. Of course, we have to delve in more into the pros and cons to understand mm-hmm. why I said why it has to be controlled and not mm-hmm. unleashed.
Yes.
Other than that, I think that social media helps us move forward and develop as a community and a society faster. And that is by the spread of information that is possible. The way of communicating is much easier, and receiving information and giving information has become much more easier.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we look at the cons of it, it goes back to fake news, right? Although fake news could have been done without social media. That's one thing to keep in mind.
Right.
Another thing is that the overload of information that mm-hmm. is available can sometimes cause confusion, especially when we're talking about beliefs, theology, ideologies. You, for example, if you open that, explore button on one of the mm-hmm. apps, could say the names, right? For example, Instagram. You open that explore button, you see hundreds of different views on one topic.
Right.
You see people who are with vaccinations, people who are against vaccinations, people who don't even care about vaccinations. Mm-hmm. You see people, for example, who support this idea and people who are against this idea, and you see mm-hmm. their claims.
Mm-hmm.
Some claims are stronger than others. Sometimes that person, that individual who's looking at social media doesn't have the power to understand what is right, what is real, and what is false.
Exactly.
So that's one of the cons, the overload of information. Another thing is that the time consumption of social media. Although I believe that when we live in a society without social media,
mm-hmm.
we can also have time consumption as well. We could go to our friend's house and just talk about meaningless things. So at the end of the day, these cons are not going to fade away if we take away social media. That's what I want to say. Moreover, I think that if it's controlled, then the goods of social media are very important to the development of humanity and society altogether.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, Brother Mahdi, your take on that?
Yeah, definitely. I think Brother Habib mentioned very great points. He highlighted some of the most important matters that mm-hmm. we all can connect to. I believe that social media is now part of our lives. You can't just take it off, remove it, and say, okay, I'm going to put my phone aside completely, get isolated from social media, We all of us have tried that when we felt we were addicted, and most of times we have failed. I myself deactivated.
Although some old generation, in fact, old school.
I think exactly.
Sometimes
like
they shy away from such new technology.
I disagree with that.
No, I'm not saying all.
Even most. You're saying most of them. No. Sorry, but my phone is filled with Sabah al Khair images on my phone. I'm very sorry for that. My mother was listening to this. She would say, "No, you're wrong."
But Brother Habib, this is the matter. I think it's all about the beginning of it. If you stayed away intentionally from the beginning, I know one of my teachers, and he's one of the university professors, and he doesn't have a phone right now in 2021. He doesn't have a phone. So anytime we want to communicate with him, we have to email him.
Yes.
Set up an appointment, whatever. Yes. And he has a home phone, landline.
I had the same experience when I was doing my MA.
And
with my supervisor.
But having mentioned a very good point, not having a phone or a smartphone, not being on social media, doesn't mean that you're secured and saved from wasting time. I can waste time on things that are not necessary for my dunya, for my world, and for the hereafter, right? So social media, that's how I describe it. It's like a street. If someone is isolating themselves and locking up the door and staying inside home, they're going to call them sick. If someone is homeless and is on the streets all the times, you're going to call them sick too.
Right.
So you need to have a balance. That Brother Habib called it controlling it. I'm saying balance. So what I do and I recommend is that anytime you get on social media, have a purpose. If you get on a car, you start the engine, but you don't have a destination to go.
You're wasting gasoline on these expensive times.
Exactly. I mean, everybody's going to call you crazy, right? But if you have a purpose, if you have a destination, then driving becomes a mean. No one's going to be like, he's addicted. Or your job is driving. For example, you're an Uber driver, right? You're circulating around the city 24/7. You're making money from it. But if there is no purpose, I'm going to meet my friend. I'm going to email that person.
Right.
There is a purpose. If not, the social media takes you. It's like a stream of a river. It just takes you, the flow of social media.
And
how many times has it been like, exactly, how many times has it been that you had a purpose? You wanted to go on, check that person's direct message, and instead you ended up like looking at the
How they make cheese.
Exactly. How they make cheesecake.
Exactly. That's the effects of lots of cookies which are popping up, in fact, on your screen, even if despite your will.
Exactly.
Well,
the idea that what he was trying to say, what my brother was trying to say here, Brother Mahdi, was that, you know, it might be clear to many that I must not waste time, social media is time consuming. But at the end of the day, when it comes to do rather than know, it's very difficult. You know, how many people know what their goals are, yet they cannot accomplish it because of the hardness of that goal? I think that social media has become hard, and that is why I don't say balance, like how you stated. I say control. When I say control, it's not only the person who is behind the phone, but rather the companies that are opening the Instagram or opening Facebook or opening, I don't know, Twitter. They are the ones that are supposed to, you know, be controlling these applications. I remember MySpace. You remember MySpace?
I do.
Yeah.
I remember there was this time where they used to put a 6-hour limit, if I'm not wrong. If you were more than 6 hours on MySpace, they would send you a message. And also the kid games as well, the same thing. I remember
right.
many
but the
clips.
Screen time can be limited.
Yeah. But the thing is that when you screen time it, it's something, and then when they screen time, it's something else. But at the end of the day, you also have this problem where, for example, many businesses are living on social media.
Do you believe, Brother Habib, that these social medias have been designed in a way to finally control over the minds of
people? Yes, and I have proof of that. And one of the executors of Instagram, actually, they were based in California for a period of time, and there was these, you know, family members, if I say their name, they might be known, they would go and ask, and they were, you know, asking about Instagram and how to, you know, use the program and whatnot at its beginnings. And one of the main things that they had was how to make it something addictive. And they don't say addictive. They would say how to make it something that drags in people, something that's like a magnet. And that was the goal of many games on many apps. And, you know, how do we bring in people? How do we make it attractive?
How do we make them stay connected?
Exactly. How do you make them always need? Because there's this business model that states
all these algorithms.
You need how to sell things more. They have it in English. Selling based on demands. So selling based on demands. How do we make it demandable? How do we make people always want to crave? Always crave this app, always want to stay on their phones because of this
app.
But
that's the ABC
game.
Of marketing. Exactly. They're
using
us
as money. Exactly. That's the thing.
In whatever field of study you have, but you have to be able actually to market it one way or another.
That's the thing. But the more smart they are and clever in doing it, the more that we're falling into problems.
And the way they have designed these social media apps, and I believe, I pray that someone comes up with a healthy social media app. Mm-hmm. That okay, if my having the idea of having social media has a deep root, even among many of the Muslim students here in Iran or other countries, I've talked to some of them from some of the universities, and they said this idea of having a social media not for the purpose of making money, mm-hmm. not for the purpose of increasing the profit, has been in our minds. We didn't have enough money to invest on it. Right. Those entrepreneurs or those investors who had a lot of money never trusted us in the beginning. So Facebook and all these huge companies, they came and take over all the social media. And what they do, the akhlaq is, there is no ethics in social media, mm-hmm. right? Look at the
ethics are liberal.
Exactly.
They're liberal ethics.
Exactly. Like, look at Instagram. The more it goes on, the more we are getting closer to I ask forgiveness from the audience, but it becomes a pornographic application with mm-hmm. all these limits of liberty that they have. Like, okay, as long as certain areas are limited or blurred, it's okay mm-hmm. to share certain mm-hmm. pictures. And then you're going to talk about truth, they will delete your account. They have absolute control over you.
I think there was this the racism thing that was happening, that they were saying that if you broadcast the football game, one of the football players was saying that if you broadcast the football game or you put a video clip taken from, for example, one of the, like BN Sports, for example, mm-hmm. they will close you down, right? But if you put on racist material or something like that, no one looks at you. No one even, comes close to you. They're trying to change that. But at the end of the day, my brother, as long as they have liberal ideas, they have that Western civilization, mm-hmm. Concepts and ideas and ideologies in them, you're not going to see what you believe in. They're not going to see what your dear brothers who wanted to put and open an application for themselves, open an application that's Islamic.
I see. I remember when there was the new technology of, the most advanced type of TVs came on,
Smart TV.
There was a smart TV or flat TV, some kind of...
Oh, plasma TVs.
Plasma, and then, before, back in the days, there were different kinds of TV. Anyway.
The year 2007, 2006 were the first years.
Yes, but we had this idea, the new idea of, or the concept of parental control or something like that, and then the parents could have, locked, for example, a few channels for their kids and the like, and so this shows that with presence of some kind of new technology, then there comes with it the culture of, let's say, sometimes controlling it one way or another. Like, for example, as Brother Habib was also referring to, like the kind of control that he liked it to be applied, in fact, to the social media as well. Sure. Thank you very much, Brother Habib and Brother Mahdi, for your nice contribution to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. I'm Ahmad Javad, signing off. We were talking about social media. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness, and everything which makes no sense, know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. Florida's version of the American Dream, which holds that even people of relatively modest means can aspire to live near the water, depends on a few crucial components: sugar white beaches, soft ocean breezes, and federal flood insurance that is heavily subsidized. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Favell. The piece is titled, "The Cost of Insuring Expensive Waterfront Homes is About to Skyrocket." Florida's version of the American Dream, which holds that even people of relatively modest means can aspire to live near the water, depends on a few crucial components: sugar white beaches, soft ocean breezes, and federal flood insurance that is heavily subsidized. But starting on 1st of October, communities in Florida and elsewhere around the country will see those subsidies begin to disappear in a nationwide experiment in trying to adapt to climate change, forcing Americans to pay something closer to the real cost of their flood risk, which is rising as the planet warms. While the program also covers homes around the country, the pain will be most acutely felt in coastal communities throughout the United States. For the first time, the new rates will also take into account the size of a home, so that large houses by the ocean could see an especially big jump in insurance rates. Federal officials say the goal is fairness and also getting homeowners to understand the extent of the risk that they face. and perhaps move to safer ground, reducing the human and financial toll of disasters. Subsidized insurance has been critical for supporting coastal real estate market, said Benjamin Keyes, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Removing that subsidy, he said, is likely to affect where Americans build houses and how much people will pay for them. It's going to require a major rethink about coastal living in the United States. The government's new approach threatens home values, perhaps nowhere as intensely as in Florida, a state which is particularly exposed to rising seas and worsening hurricanes. In some parts of the state, the cost of flood insurance will eventually increase tenfold, according to data obtained by the New York Times. For example, Jennifer Zales, a real estate agent who lives in Tampa, Florida, pays $480 a year for flood insurance. But under the new system, her insurance rate will eventually reach $7,147, according to Jake Holhouse, her insurance agent. And that is prompting lawmakers from both parties to line up to block the new rates, which will be phased in over several years. "We're extremely concerned about the administration's decision to proceed," Senator Bob Menendez, a New Jersey Democrat, and eight other senators from both political parties, including the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, wrote in a letter on Wednesday, 22nd of September, to Deanne Criswell, the administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Created by Congress in 1968, the National Flood Insurance Program is the primary provider of flood coverage, which often isn't available from private insurers. The program is funded by premiums from policyholders, but can borrow money from the Federal Treasury to cover claims. The average annual premium is $739. Until now, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which runs the program, has priced flood insurance based largely on whether a home is inside the so-called 100-year floodplain, land expected to flood during a major storm. But that distinction ignores threats like intense rainfall or a property's proximity to water. Many homeowners pay rates that understate their true risk. The result has been a program that subsidizes wealthier coastal residents at the expense of homeowners further inland, who are more often people of color or low income. As climate change makes flooding worse, using tax dollars to underwrite waterfront mansions has become increasingly hard to defend. In 2019, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, said it would instead price flood insurance based on the particular risk facing each individual property, a change the agency called Risk Rating 2.0. After a delay by the Trump administration, the new system takes effect next month for people purchasing flood insurance. For existing customers, rates will rise starting next April. The change has won applause from a grab bag of advocacy groups, including climate resilience experts, environmentalists, the insurance industry, and the budget watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense. With a rapidly escalating threat of natural disasters, Risk Rating 2.0 is a much-needed and timely change, said Laura Lightbody of Pew Charitable Trust, which has pushed governments to better respond to climate threats. Higher insurance costs, she said, were a reflection of our new wet reality. The rate hikes around Tampa Bay in Florida are unusual, according to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Most homeowners will see much smaller increases to their insurance bill, and many will experience a decrease, the first time in the history of the program, the agency said. As for those who may be forced from their homes by rising insurance rates, the agency noted that it has long urged Congress to offer financial help to lower-income residents, a more targeted type of assistance than simply subsidizing policies for most homeowners, regardless of their income. For the first time, our policyholder premiums will be based on their individual risk, said David Morstad, who runs the flood insurance program at FEMA. We pledge to continue to evaluate and make adjustments where and when it's warranted, David Morstad said. Lawmakers have responded to the change with alarm. Last week, 38 members of Congress signed a letter urging House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to block the change. We are concerned about the burden of potential double-digit rate hikes on our constituents by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA's untested pricing methodology, the letter read, calling that burden too much for them to bear. Unlike current climate policy debates, which tend to break along partisan lines, views on flood insurance are less a matter of political ideology than of geography. All but three of the members who signed the House letter represent coastal states, including five Republican lawmakers from Louisiana and all 10 Democratic House members from New Jersey. The letter was signed by 19 Democrats, including some, such as Grace Meng and Richie Torres of New York, who in other contexts have stressed the need to address the effects of climate change. Neither Grace Meng or Richie Torres responded to requests for comment. Charlie Crist, the former Republican governor of Florida, who now represents St. Petersburg as a Democrat in the House of Representatives, also signed last week's letter. He rejected the Federal Emergency Management Agency's argument that higher insurance costs would serve to alert people to the risk that they face. That's one of the most inhumane, callous statements they could possibly make, Charlie Crist said. We're going to punish you so you know what's going on. In the past, insurance policy has been vulnerable to political pressure. In 2012, Congress rolled back some of the subsidies in the flood insurance program, only to reverse course just 2 years later after voters objected to higher insurance costs. But the growing threat of climate change may make that kind of intervention less successful, said Roy Wright, who ran the flood insurance program until 2018 and now runs the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. We cannot hide the truth of this increasing risk, Roy Wright said. We shouldn't hide it. We should tell people the truth.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.